Would you join me, please, in a word of prayer? Lord, may the words of my mouth and the thoughts of all those assembled prove acceptable in your sight, my strength, my rock, my redeemer. Amen. Well, welcome again to worship here today as we start. I'm starting a new series. We'd wrapped up our old one. That's in the past. It was fun, but it's time to move on. And what I wanted to move on with is this new series called 101 Blank Days of Summer. Now, you may think, like, my family loves Phineas and Ferb, or at least the younger people, that whole intro song thing. There's 101 days of summer vacation. That's not what it was. That's not where I got the 101. They didn't invent that. Actually, the first thing that I thought of, and the reason I titled it this, is way back in the day when I was in the military, they had this thing called the 101 Critical Days of Summer. And what that really meant, they just mapped it out and said there's about 101 days in summer. That's where Phineas and Ferb got that same number. There's 101 days, and people have a lot of accidents over the summer. So we're going to make everybody go to a briefing every single year, no matter how many times you've done it. I did 20 years of briefings where I had to sit in an auditorium or wherever they crammed us and listen to somebody tell me, don't use gasoline to start your grill. I never learned it, apparently, because I had to hear it again about, suntan lotion, whatever it is. You don't go kill yourself this summer. You're going to break your leg playing softball. Don't do that. All these rules, and they called it critical days of summer because, I think it was critical for them to keep you from hurting yourself because they'd get fired. That's what it really came down to. I didn't title it the critical days of summer. I left that blank. And what I would like is for us to, through this series, as we start to prepare for summer, because it's coming. I don't know if you knew that. It's hard to keep track of time sometimes. I've really lost track of time, and I don't see that changing all that much. But regardless of whether we know it's coming or not, summer is coming. So let's prepare for it. And what I'm hoping is, through these next few weeks, we're going to make these 101 days of summer not just critical, not just, fill in the blank with negative stuff, but we're going to put some positive words in there. And today we're talking about compassion and forgiveness. The things that we talked about earlier, I talked in the children's message, because if we fill our summer with these kinds of things, well, we're going to benefit from that. And the time to start is now. And really, the way to start, what I wanted to start with today, was this article in a magazine, online magazine, that somebody linked to my Facebook page. It was titled, let me see if I can find the title here, it was titled, Some of the Most Visible Christians in America Are Failing the Coronavirus Test. And here's a guy who went to journalism school, and they said, let people know what your article is going to be about just by the title. So I have some excerpts from that. I wanted to start with this one right here. Here's one of the lines in here. Consider the popular pastor John Piper, who was asked what he would say to pastors who claim that the pandemic is God's judgment on sinful cities and arrogant nations. God sometimes uses disease to bring particular judgments upon those who reject him and give themselves over to sin, Piper responded. I just have to pause here for just a second and say, God does use things, various things, war, disease, whatever, as judgment on people. He did that in the Old Testament. But as I read the Bible, when he did that, he pronounced it beforehand with multiple prophets. He said when it was going to begin. He said how long it was going to last, so that there was no question that this was judgment from God. And I didn't hear any of those things before this pandemic came out. Did you? Nope. I sure heard a bunch of people say the same thing about Katrina, that this was judgment from God. I think largely these guys are cranks, though. The Bible also very clearly says, by the way, in Hebrews, that in former days God spoke through the prophets, but in these days he has spoken through his Son, Jesus Christ. And that's a different kind of message, isn't it? This is a message of reconciliation, of forgiveness, of compassion. That's right, compassion. So when you hear people say this, you can kind of cringe like I do. I really wish they would not put themselves in the place of a prophet if they were not called by God to do that. But at the very least, we cannot join in saying that this is God's judgment on people. All right, so continuing on with the same article. He says, or perhaps look to R.R. Reno, the editor of the conservative Christian journal First Things, who argued that it's not worth a mass shutdown of society just to fight the virus. There's a demonic side to the sentimentalism of saving lives at any cost. And then he asks this particularly pointed question. He says, is this what it looks like to be pro-life now? That kind of stings, doesn't it? The amazing thing, as I look around today, I've actually noticed that there's a lot of really liberal folks who are now crying out about the sanctity of life, and there's a lot of conservative folks who are crying back, no, freedom of choice. I need to be able to exercise my freedom. If this world wasn't crazy enough before, you know, now we've got this complete reversal that I never thought I would live to see. But we need to ask ourselves this question. You know, is this what it means to be pro-life now? The world is paying attention. And if we're saying, you know, pro-life means I want to control what you do, but when it inconveniences me, I'm not really willing to put up with that. That's not a very good message for Christians to talk about what they think is important. We have to be careful how we're going to be heard. Now, if you are on the other side of this debate, if you have found yourself criticizing the people around you, the governor, whoever it may be, the government, for not taking enough action, if you've been shaming people, right, and criticizing people on social media and saying you are in the absolute wrong, what are you thinking? You're trying to kill people if you don't go in covered in latex and dipped in Lysol everywhere you go, and you shouldn't really go anywhere. I just want to encourage you to consider some things before you make your next post or you make your next statement or proclamation about how everybody else needs to be on board and doing what you think is right. The first is just simply this. Their goal, the people with whom you disagree, their goal really is not to spread the virus. If you're disagreeing with somebody online, just stop and consider for a second. They're not trying to infect you or your immune-compromised grandmother. And you may say, well, that doesn't matter what their intention is. I want to pause for just a second and say, doesn't it, though? It should at least matter in the way that we talk to somebody. We talk to somebody differently if they're actually trying to hurt us versus they just have a different opinion. That's something else that I'd like to consider. Reasonable people, reasonable minds, they can disagree on things. And a lot of what I see as far as disagreement is not our lives worth saving, but is this the best course of action? Is this the best way to save lives? I know that sometimes there's one scientist standing on the stage when a pronouncement is made, but that doesn't mean that he represents the entire scientific community. Not everybody is in agreement on this. And some people, I think, have raised some pretty legitimate concerns about who's controlling the narrative and what they have to gain. There's a lot of people making a lot of money here. So we may not all be on the same page. And if you're starting to think, you know, Pastor Mike, this sounds like a weird conspiracy theory. Yeah, maybe it does. Maybe it does. But that leads me to my third point, and that's this. How we treat people with whom we disagree is a sign of our compassion. So if you don't agree with the conspiracy theorists, that's okay. We are kind of crazy. I admit it. But how we deal with people who we think are cranks and who don't really express what we would consider the correct view, well, that's an important sign of our compassion. Christians are no longer really recognized for their compassion. And man, we need to reclaim that. And the way that we do that Or one of the ways that we do that is we show compassion, we show forgiveness, we show understanding to people we don't agree with. Anybody can agree with people who are saying the same things that we say. Anyone can show compassion to those kinds of people. But when you don't agree, and yet you can still be kind and understanding, you can seek to understand what they say and what they represent and what their perspective is, that's supposed to be what we're known for, and I think it can be what we're known for again. So keep these things in mind as we look at today's lesson. Today's lesson, it jumps in really at the very end of Genesis, and it covers a whole lot of stuff a whole lot of stuff that we need to cover now. I'm going to be really pretty brief about it. The story of Joseph, it kind of ends in that very chapter, but it begins way back in Genesis 37, where this guy Joseph, one of 12 brothers, the 12 tribes of Israel, was sort of the favorite son of his father, and his brothers did not appreciate. You talk about sibling rivalry. These guys did not appreciate his brother. And if they didn't like him before, just wait until he starts having these dreams. In chapter 37, Joseph starts having these dreams about how his brothers are going to bow down to him. He's going to rule over all of his older brothers. Now, that doesn't fly in today's world, but it really didn't fly in the ancient world. It says after Joseph had shared the dream, they understood what this dream meant, and they were ready to just beat him behind the woodshed. And yet, Joseph has a second dream where not only his brothers worshipped him and bowed down to him, but his mother and father did as well. And here's just a thought. Maybe if your brothers hate you for sharing that first dream, I don't know, kids, don't share the second dream. Say, thank you, Lord, that is awesome. I trust you that this will happen. But maybe just keep that to yourself. Dear diary, even. But Joseph doesn't do that. He shares that dream as well. And if they hated him before, they doubly hated him now. They hated him so much that when they're out tending the flocks, Joseph comes out to him and they beat him and they throw him in a cistern. And then they sell him into slavery. And Joseph's life just gets worse from there. He goes and works for this guy named Potiphar, and he's accused of crime he didn't commit. And he's thrown into a dungeon. He went from being a slave and worked his way up in that house down to being a prisoner. And eventually, he works his way up through that prison and is rescued and brought into the service of the Pharaoh and becomes the second most powerful person in Egypt. This is an amazing rags-to-riches story. We don't have time to talk about it here. It's covered in the amazing Technicolor Dream Code. I think you can still find that. That's where I got that picture, although that's not the Donny Osmond version. And at the end of this, he brings his brothers and his father back into Egypt with him and takes care of them and forgives them. It's a great tearful reunion. And after that, his father dies. His father's really at peace with his family. His son, who he thought was lost, has been returned. His whole family's together. Everybody's happy. And then the father passes away. Jacob passes away at peace. And it's after that that today's reading picks up. Let's take a look at that again. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgressions of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph had already forgiven them, and yet the brothers, they're convinced that he didn't really forgive them. They're convinced that he only pretended to be forgiving and compassionate, and really, Joseph was holding on to a grudge and just waiting for Dad to die so that he could really pay back the brothers for all the evil that they have done. Now, if you have held on to a grudge in your life, or if you're holding on to one now, there's some truth about grudges that I want you to know. The first is that grudges make sense. And they're the most natural thing in the world. When somebody does something that is wrong, when somebody hurts us, treats us with injustice, well, we respond to that. We may react and try to chastise them, try to rebel against them, try to put them down. But if they don't respond in the way that we want, we're going to hold a grudge against them. The Bible actually makes provisions for people who are fleeing from the Avenger of Blood. If you killed somebody in my family, I'm going to get you back. God says, I know you're going to act like that. He doesn't condone it, but he expects it. He knows that this is how we behave. And the brothers, well, they're just behaving the way that everybody else does. They expect Joseph to hold a grudge because it's exactly what they would do. I had this friend, I actually had a couple friends years ago. Dean Gonzalez, he's the guy who taught me how to rock climb. And he had we had a mutual friend, I guess, Brian Edmonds, Edmo. And Edmo was he was taught to climb before Dean. He was a better climber than I was, but he's not quite as good a climber as Dean. And they had, I don't know, they had a relationship that was kind of tricky, I guess. Edmo had wanted to overcome him, but I think he hadn't yet. And that's where there's a lot of friction, I think. Well, Dean and I were going to climb Half Dome, and in order to do that in Yosemite Valley, California, there's this long hike to get there. And man, there's a lot of heavy climbing equipment that you got to take. It's like a 9-mile hike. You gain 4,500 feet. And so we needed some help. And Edmo says, don't worry, my wife and I are going to show up there and we'll help you. We'll carry all the climbing gear for you and let you do it. And then you can come down, and going downhill with that stuff is no problem. Thank you, Edmo. It's such a long hike. Edmo didn't show up. And man, that was, I think to date, that is probably the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. There's one point where as we're carrying our packs, I had the good backpack, so mine was heavier. I think it was around 125 pounds. As we're walking up this incredibly steep switchback, I see Dean doing this for a little while, and I think, oh my gosh, is he having a heart attack? And he pronounces, we have been in our target heart rate for 10 hours now. Thought we were going to die, and not for one step, I think, did we forget that Edmo bailed on us. In fact, we started doing this thing where